Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and you're listening to the Yacht Racing Podcast for what is the 13th and final episode of our special series of Vendée Globe episodes. Joining me on the show once more from Lorient in France is ocean racing expert and Vendée Globe skipper himself, Conrad Coleman. Hi there, Conrad.
G'day. I've just catching my breath after that finale.
Yeah, well, it's been a big week. It's always a big week when we talk about the Vendée Globe. But it's finally, can you believe it, it's finally come to a conclusion, or finally has come to a conclusion for at least the top group of boats. The leaders have made it back to Le Sable d'Olon after 11 plus weeks at sea. And we finally have a winner for the ninth Vendée Globe. Congratulations go to Yannick Bestaven for, I think what we can describe as a pretty stunning final week at sea that saw him seal his victory in the early hours of Thursday, January 28th. I know you were up watching most of it. I was too. But he wasn't the first boat home, was he, Conrad? It's not just a simple line honours win that we normally expect. Can you give us a bit of a sense of what went on that night? Because there was plenty of tension and even drama on that last night at sea for the leading group.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, you know, one of the things that I particularly like about open class racing is that there's no handicap. It's not like IRC where you're chasing numbers and trying to figure out whether you're ahead or you're behind. And so typically the first person across the line is the one that takes the cake, or at least the trophy. And in this case, Charlie Darlan, of course, won the race and put on a masterclass from start to finish. But ultimately, when he crossed the line, we knew that he was only going to refer to himself as the first across the line and not the ultimate winner, because the clock started. And just for those that haven't been following it as closely as we have over these last few weeks, remember that these time, they're not time bonuses, they're compensation coefficients or time that was added onto, or subtracted rather, from the time from Yannick Bestaven, Boris Herman, and Jean Lecam, who all participated in the rescue of Kevin on PRB when his boat split in half in the first third of the race. And so they were diverted away from their racing line, and eventually Jean picked Kevin up out of the water. And obviously once you divert and the sense of seamanship and safety comes, of course, before any racing. But then equally, it isn't a race. There should be compensation. And that's why these final time credits kicked into effect at the finish.
And that's right. And that all happened, let's just remember, back on around the 1st of December is when the search and rescue operation was being coordinated, you know, between the race committee and the rescue authorities down in the Southern Ocean. And again, thinking back to that, you know, we were all pretty worried about Kevin. We all breathed a big sigh of relief when he finally scrambled on the back of John Lecam's boat. And, you know, that could have worked out very differently, couldn't it? So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't without some concern that these guys diverted from their course.
Yeah, very definitely. And, you know, just to finish with the subject, and then we'll get on with the rest of it. You know, Damien Seguin got himself in a little bit of hot water by criticizing these compensated times by saying, "Oh, you know, it's ruining the purity of the race," and he was sort of quite critical of it all. But I think subsequently, all of the people that were actually affected by these time bonuses, most notably Charlie and Louis and so on, said normally but ultimately graciously that of course, you know, the rules are the rules. The time was applied by the international jury. There's no favoritism. It was calculated on the time that they lost in the search. And one of the things that we always say as round the world sailors is that our competitors are the ones that are most likely to come and pluck us out of the water if anything goes wrong. And, you know, you wouldn't want those compensation times not to be honored, and then in 4 or 8 years' time, even have the most minute hesitation on the part of a sailor saying, oh, well, actually, I'd really like, you know, prefer to continue on with my race, and you know, not pick up the phone when the race director calls and asks for if you to divert. So, you know, as a sailor and as a racing sailor, but also more widely as somebody who goes to sea, I'm 100% behind these compensations being awarded, and ultimately so is everybody else who's affected by them. So Charlie was very gracious in accepting Yannick and saying he won the race, and he really did, you know.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about Charlie Dallin's kind of final week at sea, because he was one of the people we had tipped right from the beginning as a potential winner of the race, and I think he's possibly the only one of the new boats that were tipped that's kind of really delivered on that promise. I mean, we saw Alex Thompson crash out of the race. We saw the Shirelle skipper, whose name is
Jeremy Beal. Yep,
Jeremy Beal. You know, we saw him have problems, have to return to Le Sable d'Olonne, and he's still out racing now. But Charlie on his first race, first Vendée Globe, of course, let's remember that, and lived through some pretty difficult times, and he was the first boat home. That's pretty impressive performance, I think.
It is. I think that it demonstrates that you need to be a really solid sailor, which of course Charlie was, incredibly well prepared, be given a new boat. And in many ways, he replicated the recipe of François Gabart, with a great mentor who, in François's case, was called Michel Desjoyeaux, with a new boat, very highly developed, one of the latest ones to go into the water. And then an incredible team that was there to back him up as well. And Charlie talked about that, saying that his team was actually the same as that of François. His project was hosted by François's company, Meilleur Concept, and certainly benefited from a lot of François Gabart's experience and his collective team. And during his last press conference, Charlie said, you know, I felt surrounded by this team at all times. Ultimately, me as the skipper, I was the one that was climbing the mast and shaking out the reefs and putting the effort in. But I felt surrounded by this team and carried by the team. So, you know, it's irritatingly, as somebody who has done three races around the world and has won only one of them, it seems that there are other ways of accumulating the experience and resources that are required to do a really good race. So, and he really did. You know, he overcame the problems, particularly with his foil, and put together a masterclass. And in the last couple of days, as you were saying, he took a very different route, most notably from Yannick. And we'll talk about why Yannick went so far north in a second. But Charlie did say that tactically he was trying to split from the guys that he owed time to, in the hope that that things would shake out, that he could overcome the hours that he owed them. And so that's why he very intentionally split from them, chose that southern route towards the Cape Finisterre on the northwest corner of Spain, rather than going for the sort of faster, stronger wind route that the others chose.
And your view of that approach, because to me it looked like he had to do an awful lot of jibes along the north coast of Spain there. It didn't look like a fast approach to me, but you were looking at the routing software. Tell me.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, personally, I would have chosen the northern route because it felt like more of a sure thing. But then, you know, we did see that Charlie's boat has been handicapped, that he said that he's been sailing largely without the support of his port foil for the return up the Atlantic. He had a sort of cat's cradle of string holding the foil onto the boat, and so it wasn't really providing the boost that he needed. So he was definitely you know, part of the walking wounded. And I think that it was to his benefit to be sailing in lighter winds because he had less of a handicap than had he been in stronger conditions where you would be looking to benefit from that foil and he wouldn't have been able to.
Interesting, interesting. And the northern route, it did seem to pay off for the people who went that way. But let's talk a little bit first about the, in the last episode, we talked a lot about the big storm that was going to come in and we thought was going to play a major factor. It didn't play as big a factor as we thought, did it?
Well, storm insofar as, you know, it wasn't survival conditions at the end. But the big depression that we saw coming, I would say was a big factor in the sense that it won the race for Yannick because it provided him enough wind that came at just the right time to give him the boost that he needed to play his cards and sail the northern route. And the reason that they went north was looking for the extra wind coming out of that system. And just to continue along the logic there, Yannick, of course, I've referred to it in my columns and on your website, and also we've talked about it previously, is that Yannick referred to the fact that when he went around Cape Horn, he had absolutely horrendous conditions. And all the years that he's been sailing, he'd never seen something so bad. He estimated that the swells were 8 to 10 meters, that he was surfing down the swells at 35 knots, even though he was trying to slow the boat down. And when he piled into the back of one swell, having surfed down the front of one, that's when he nosedived the boat so hard that it ripped off the sorry, I'm trying to translate from French to English. Ripped off the pulpit, damaged his furling equipment, and actually limited the amount of sails that he could use in his climb back up the Atlantic. So that was extremely penalizing for him, and that's ultimately why he lost the lead. And he said that he didn't have full access to his full sail wardrobe. He had access to his smaller sails, and that's again why he went looking for the stronger wind. And so it's really a case of circumstance, you know, looking for stronger winds, having his hand forced by the sail wardrobe that he had access to, sailing in stronger winds that were ultimately more stable and allowed him to claw back the time that he needed on the boats ahead.
And his time compensation, the redress time was 10 hours and 15 minutes, I think.
Yes, that's right.
He needed nearly all of that, didn't he? He needed a large chunk of that to overtake Charlie Dallin's elapsed time.
That's right. Ultimately, the delta was less than 3 hours between him and Charlie. Yeah,
which is a mind-blowingly close finish.
Well, it's funny you say that because I've been crunching the numbers on that one, and I just wanted to put a little bit of perspective on how this shaped up both in terms of sailing and also other events in sport. So in comparison, the time difference between Amel Lucliaș and Alex Thompson in 4 years ago was 16 hours after 74 days of racing. And here we had 80 days of racing, so they were almost a week later, but then ultimately the gap was less than 3 hours. So to put that in percentage terms, there was basically 0.9% between Alex and Armel, and here we have 0.13% difference between Yannick and Charlie Dana. So just, you know, absolutely astonishing. That's 1,923 and 3/4 hours of racing time for Yannick. And so nearly 2,000 hours, and it is less than 3, so that's 0.13% difference, delta. To put that in perspective, a 30-minute race in the America's Cup with a delta of 18 seconds, as we saw on the last of the round robins between Ineos and Luna Rossa, is 1.1%. So almost 10 times a wider gap in the America's Cup than we're seeing here in the Vendée Globe. So it's completely insane. And to put that in perspective, fantastic. Again, in the Rio Olympics with a 100-meter sprint, you had, of course, Usain Bolt line up against the American sprinter Justin Gatlin. It's of course a 9 second and change race, 10 second race. It's won by eight one hundredths of a second. And so naturally that equates to a percentage difference of 0.815. So again, to be talking about a time difference of 0.13, I know this is lots of numbers, but basically it is 7 times tighter than a 100 meter sprint and 10 times tighter than America's Cup race. This race deserves our respect.
That Conrad deserves some respect, but that number crunching is some world-class number crunching. Thank you so much for that, because there's no way I could have done that.
No worries. It's amazing. just put it in perspective. Seven times tighter than a 100 meter sprint is just astonishing.
It really is, and it says an awful lot about this race that it has been this close, and I suspect that it's been a more entertaining race for it. And I think it's kept people engaged, certainly kept me more engaged than I normally would be throughout the whole race.
I think it speaks to the fact that the fleet, that the race is changing. As we, 2008, we had almost 50% of the fleet dropping out with technical failures or dismastings or whatever. So 50% attrition, and that has been coming down and down and down in 2012 and 2016. And here, in so many ways, we've been saying that this edition is unprecedented. And certainly just having, I'm looking now at 25 sailors of the original 30, 31 or however many boats started, still in the race is absolutely astonishing. And it speaks to the increasing professionalism in the class. Yes, this can be criticized because the budgets are just astronomical now, but it means that it's no longer a sailor and his childhood buddies, getting together and splicing some ropes and sticking some bits of carbon together. That's absolutely the heritage of this race, but it led to significant breakages and abandons and significant time gaps. And here we're seeing bigger teams with more specialists and better preparation. I think ultimately that COVID played a big role in that by cancelling a lot of the events early on in the year that allowed everybody to really work on their preparation. They ultimately sailed less, which means that there was less wear and tear on the boats. And then this is the Grand Cru of this edition is absolutely astonishing to have such differences, such small differences between the boats all the way through has just been remarkable.
It's interesting you bring up that point that the boats have done less sea miles because of COVID, less chance for the events to happen. I've always questioned when people say, well, we're really surprised that the keel fell off because we'd done 10,000 miles of sailing and there'd been no problem. It always struck me that maybe it fell off because you'd done 10,000 miles of sailing and that was all it could take.
Well, I hope it takes more than 10,000 given that the race course is 28,000 miles long. But yes, I absolutely understand your point. But then equally, ultimately the boat was won by a boat that was launched in 2015. It's pretty interesting because we're seeing even some of the I don't think it's become public knowledge yet, but there are some of the teams that are in this race have already pushed the button on or signed up for next race and are already designing and getting ready to build their new boats, presumably to have them ready for the Route de Rome in 2022. And the fact that there's such a race already to get building for the next race in 2024 is a testament to the fact that I think everybody was pretty surprised by just how complicated these boats have become, and the load of developing them and realizing that they need a longer runway, that you can't be launching these boats as we saw with Corum in the year of the race, because you just don't have time to sort everything out, even even with all the money and all of the time, with all the team in the world, these boats require time to get ready. And that's what we saw this year with COVID. But it's becoming even more the case now. So look for some announcements in the weeks ahead as to who's already signed up for the next one.
That's great insider knowledge. And I know I hear a lot from fans of the race saying, oh, it would be great if it was every 2 years and not every 4 years. Why do we have to wait so long? But the point you make is that it takes that full four-year cycle to be able to get boats ready.
It does, absolutely.
So let's talk some about some of our other favourites in this race. Louis Burton was somebody I had tipped as who could be the line honours winner and could even have snatched the overall title. Tell us about his final week at sea, because I suspect he's a very happy man right now.
And rightly so. You know, he is in many ways the sort of dark horse candidate. In that he lives in Saint-Malo and then in northern Brittany, and there is really this dividing line between northern Brittany and southern Brittany where I live, and you know, almost everybody is concentrated down here, and in many ways he has been sort of building up his own racing school. You know, he's in addition to running his own campaign, he has been very active in supporting other sailors from Saint-Malo, particularly get campaigns together in class 40s, and so he's really running a racing stable with several horses in it. So he's been doing his own thing, and I think he feels quite rightly very vindicated, because he was turned away, as he said in his press conference at the end of the race. He was turned away from the elite pôle de compétition in Port-au-Floyd, where most of the other guys are based, and forced to go his own way, and it's proved to be very effective.
Why was he turned away?
Because he didn't have the credentials to be seen as an elite competitor. Likewise, I've been turned away there, but that's because I'm not French, and it is the elite training center is seen as part of the French high performance training system, and is sort of reserved for largely for French sailors. So he, you know, quite rightly feels vindicated by this, and also he was put under pressure because he convinced his partner to buy the boat from that one last time, and has worked really hard to be a sailor worthy of their boat and worthy of the respect from his, not the respect, the support of his partner, I think one of the things that was very consistent through all of the press conferences was every single person in the race, but certainly even everyone in the top five, said there was a moment in this race when I thought I was cooked, that I thought about abandoning. It looked like the mountain was too hard to climb, and yet I fought on, and here I am. Which is a good lesson to take away from this for everybody who's been sort of a bit beat down by the goings on the last 15 months or so, with a year or so with COVID. But it's what it means is that getting into difficulty is not just something that's reserved for those that get pushed out of contention. Those that win the race. Are those that had to fight for just to keep their race alive as well. So that's why I love listening to the press conferences at the end, because that's when they finally let their guard down and they tell the real stories as to what they got into.
Like you did, Conrad.
Exactly. I got swept overboard, by the way. So he sailed the last week as he did the entire race, which is absolutely balls to the wall, full speed, and it looked like he was like he could have won it. So he ultimately made it into the last stages of the race with a boat that was largely not handicapped, still despite having to work in the systems, fully functioning autopilot, fully functioning foils and sails. And he made a dive right for that high pressure, high wind zone, the depression, and came ripping into the sub-balloon at full speed. Very, very almost, it caused a big upset.
So he was second home, and we were pleased to see him do that. A word about Thomas Ryan, who was third home on the water. He was also handicapped with his foil. What was significant about his words once he got back ashore? Did you manage to tune into his press conference?
Yeah, I got bits and pieces from that one, and of course he felt very much like it was unfinished business, that he had the full package going into the start of the race with a new boat, and he had performed very well with it early on in the warm up races, and he felt like, he just couldn't catch a break either. That once, when he was fighting for the lead, and he had to chop half of his foil off because the shaft, the structure of it had broken, that he was just sufficiently handicapped to a point that that he could no longer really contend. And then otherwise, of course, he had the standard difficulties and fixes and so on that everybody else had to face. But he felt like he was not able to express his full potential, certainly.
But still impressive to finish in that top group with a boat that's been handicapped for a large percentage of the race. I'm personally pretty impressed with that one.
Yep.
Which brings us on to our German skipper, Boris Herrmann. He's a friend of both of ours, and it didn't really go the way we wanted it to go for Boris, did it, over the last couple of days, and certainly on the last 100 miles.
On the last night, exactly.
I can't bear to say it. You say it.
Well, I'm sure that those of you listening at home know what happened. But basically, the last night of the race, Boris had a collision with a Basque fishing boat, which Boris was asleep. At the time, he was not aware of an alarm going off, either for the AIS or the radar or OSCAR, the visual obstacle avoidance piece of equipment that he has on board, and woke up with a thump as the boat hit the fishing boat, and his foil was caught up in the boat. His masthead shroud was caught up in the boat. The outrigger was bouncing along the side, and ultimately, what allowed him to release him back into the darkness of the night was that his topmast shroud failed, thankfully on the leeward side, and he managed to keep the rig up, but he sailed away from the fishing boat, and then managed to secure the mast and reduce the sails and slowly limp his way into the sub-balloon. But ultimately, that incident meant that he lost an almost assured third place, given his time compensation that was due to him. And he should have been in third place, and ultimately he ends up fifth overall. And so there's a little bit of controversy here because Boris admitted that he was asleep. Ultimately, so it says have to sleep at some point, and we have these systems on board. As I said, the radar, the AIS proximity alarm, and Boris said that he didn't hear those alarms and had theorized that they didn't go off because the boat, the fishing vessel, was not broadcasting on AIS, and certainly I can attest to the fact that frequently they don't. And the annoying thing about this is that this AIS, the automatic identification system, that broadcasts your position automatically to all other users around you, obviously broadcasts where you are. And I think that there's a some tactical game of cat and mouse that goes on between the fishermen. That is, if they hit the jackpot and they're hauling in all the fish they want, then sometimes they flip the switch and go dark so that they don't tell their buddies that they've struck it rich. So they've certainly, in my experience, say in the Gulf of Gascogne or the Bay of Biscay, be they French fishermen or Spanish fishermen, then I've often encountered boats that don't have AIS working. But then a couple of days after Boris's arrival, then I found that there was an article in the press about these fishermen who had sort of piped up to defend themselves, saying that they had admittedly had this collision with a boat that they thought was very strange, because obviously this happens pretty rarely. During the kerfuffle, when the two boats were entangled, they didn't see anybody on board, and they thought that it was a drug running boat that was doing its best to be sailing in a secretive mode, and they tried to hail him on the radio, and they didn't get a response. And it was only later, when they heard them in the press talking about this collision, that they sort of put two and two together and realized just who had hit them. And so the boat, the Hermanos Busto, is the name of the fishing boat, continued on fishing that night, and then went back to their Spanish home port on Saturday. So, you know, maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle. Maybe there was a malfunction. Maybe he was deeply asleep and didn't hear an alarm that went off. But it's a shame, because ultimately it makes everybody look bad if there's a collision at sea. And it's a shame that it happens to Boris, because we have commented all the way through this race that he is incredibly conservative, that he takes care of his security. And ultimately, I'm surprised to see that it's Boris that hit somebody, given the care that he takes. But it reminds us of 2 years ago when Alex Thompson fell asleep into a very deep sleep, didn't hear his alarm or his alarm failed, and he ended up smacking Guadeloupe. So it just means that you need to be very, very careful at the end of the races when you're incredibly fatigued.
Yeah, and of course, there's echoes of the Volvo Ocean race finishing in Hong Kong with a collision with a fishing boat, which ended up with a fatality amongst the fishing boat's crew. I don't want to draw too many comparisons with that, but this is something which must be taxing the organizers of these major yacht races about how they finish them and the safety aspect of that. And that's probably a story we can save for another day, I think. I want to talk about Jean Lacam, because he is, with his time allowance, his time redress,
yep,
that puts him in fourth place, which is a fantastic result. And he surely must have got a huge response, if not in person, virtually from the French population, who've been cheering him around the world, haven't they?
I mean, Jean Lacam, he's a huge character in our sport, and in many ways he has surpassed our sport to become a great fan of the French public, that's for sure. Think about his race, that he was going into his fifth race with an old boat, with a small budget, and he's there because he loves the sea and he loves ocean racing. And he saves the life of one of his competitors along the way, and has this incredible story, gets awarded by great honors by the French president. Has a chat to the French president, by the way, as he's sailing along in the Southern Ocean, and then comes home and is ultimately ends up just off the foot of the podium, as he says, the Place Polycon. He says that it's the stupid place in the rankings because you're not on the podium. But ultimately, an incredible animator of the race, that he was always there or thereabouts and sailing far beyond the boat's capacities and showing that, a great contrast to the young sort of whippersnappers like Maxime Sorel, who just finished. He drinks red wine and has a great time out there and has the experience to place his boat at the right time in the right place and to push himself when he needs to and rest when he doesn't. So, yeah, just incredible performance. Absolutely hats off. His name is Le Roi Jean, the King King Jean, and he aptly deserves it.
Absolutely. He is a complete enigma. And I heard the rumor was that the French president was the one who was bragging that he had a conversation with Jean Le Cam.
That's hilarious.
And not the other way around.
That's great.
All right. So listen, this race, we should acknowledge the fact that there are still lots of boats still out there and going to finish. We're not going to keep our podcast going until everybody's home, just because of other demands on our time. But, nothing but respect for all of these sailors who are hopefully going to complete the race in one piece and safely. But your view of the race in general, what can we take away from it, Conrad, in terms of, maybe the angle with the fact that it's been a slow race and that the foilers haven't really lived up to their expectations and certainly have proved to be a little fragile. Any key takeaways for you?
Well, I think there's going to be lots of, there already has been, but there will be certainly going forward, lots of head scratching as to how to build a boat that can be sailed fast by a solo sailor in rough conditions. Ultimately, that's why we saw Groupe Apicil, the really old boat skippered by Damien Seguin, keeping up with the others, particularly in the Indian Ocean, because it has a lot of rocker, a lot of curvature in its hull. It lifts its bow nicely. You can push it really, really hard without it sticking its nose in the waves and slowing down. Whereas Charlie on Apicil, theoretically a much, much faster boat, was not going faster in the Indian. And he said that he had massive decelerations every 15 seconds for a week as he slammed into waves at a great rate of knots and was constantly accelerating and decelerating. So much so that he ended up rigging up a system of nets to stop him being thrown into the forward bulkheads. And he had these catch Charlies, as he called them, set up to stop him getting bodily injured inside the boat. And so I think that there's a pretty strong consensus that these boats with the big foils and their very flat hulls need to be reworked a little bit, because when you are as Louis Burton said, he got completely destroyed in the speed runs on the PR days that we do as a fleet. That the theoretical speed difference between them was just absolutely insane between his boat from 2016 and the new ones from 2020. And yet we've seen that he was often the fastest boat in the fleet. And so it's going to be a case of building a really crunching the numbers and looking at what makes a boat go fast in all kinds of conditions, rather than just the sweet flat water conditions that Charlie described with such love and yet with such frustration, because they were those moments when he could really exploit the potential of his boat were so rare. So I think that, Naval architects and skippers and teams have got got some hard work to do as to where to find the good compromise. As to it being a slow race overall, well, that's not the architect's fault, but because the boats are faster than they ever have been. The wind was such that the lead boats never got a break and never got into a system where they could link or never got into a flow where you could link several systems together to really make a break. It's quite possible that that's not a definitive problem, and that the next race will see one, two, or three boats really, really make a big break for it, as we've seen previously. So, I think the takeaways ultimately are that even though the sailors are, as I said, better supported by the teams in the lead up to the race, and now ever more connected by always on 24/7. Set connections, that ultimately it is still a solo race, that that when you're in trouble, nobody is there to extend a hand for comfort or help you carry the tools that you need to the top of the mast, that even as some parts of the race you might say are being lost to modernity or professionalism, ultimately it is truly a solo exploit, and that's why everybody deserves our ultimate respect. Be it Charlie building a new support for his foil, or Pip here replacing her rudder just before Cape Horn. You know, throughout the fleet there are incredible stories at every level. And nobody has it easy, and that's what makes it so exciting.
I think one of the things that will come out of this race is there'll be a bumper crop of great sailing books, hopefully in time for next Christmas, when everybody gets to tell their stories. And Pip Hare, Louis Burton, Charlie Dallin, and certainly Yannick Bestervan have all got great, great stories to tell, as has everybody who's done this race. Conrad, what have we got to look forward to next as this race is winding down over these few weeks? There are some events coming up, aren't there? The Ocean Race Europe in May and June is coming up?
Yes, that's right. It's going to be the first combined event between the Volvo One Design 65 boats and the Imoca fleet. So obviously, there's a collaboration between Imoca and the Ocean Race for the next Ocean Race, which was meant to be this year, but it's now been pushed back 12 months. And so ultimately, we will be seeing these two very different boats be raced against each other. They both have very strong points and very significant weak points relative to each other. And so it's going to be exciting to see a mixed fleet battling it out in fully crewed mode around the world. So that's next year, but as you quite rightly said, in the early summer we've got this warm up, so we're excited to see what happens there. And then for those of you that are pure fans of the shorthanded ocean racing, is the Imoca season rolls on with the double-handed Transat Jacques Vabre, leaving Le Havre, and then obviously going across the Atlantic at the end of next year, and the show goes on, and it'll be exciting to see how, you know, who of the current fleet is able to move up, you know, upsell their sponsors, their current sponsors onto newer, faster boats. Who is able to keep their partners even in this challenging financial times, and ultimately, who's the new blood coming in next time? Because the rookies have really put on a good show this time.
It all sounds very exciting. That's the big picture, Conrad. Zone it right into the Conrad Coleman world. What have you got planned?
Well, I was obviously frustrated to miss out on this edition. I got very close, but no cigar this time. I am already in discussions with potential sponsors, and trying my very, very best to get into the next edition, obviously in 2024. But as soon as I can get to sea, the better, as far as I'm concerned. And also my wife, because I think she's a bit sick of having me underfoot. So I'm looking for partners who are interested in participating in the circuit and interested in using this circuit to demonstrate the imminent transfer to clean and green energy, because that's where my heart lies. And so that's the story I want to tell by racing around the world.
And where can they contact you, Coleman, just in case anybody's listening out there?
Through social media or through my website, conradcoleman.com, or Facebook or Instagram or. So thank you very much.
Perfect. Well, that's a well worth the plug for that. And I wish you really, really, really well with that. I guess that means that come the next race, I have to find somebody else to do the podcast with. But I guess for you, I'll allow you to follow your dreams.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
It has been fun. And I want to express my gratitude to you. Thanks for all of your fantastic input. I'm really proud that we've managed to do this every week. We've got lots of lovely feedback from everybody, and I think people have generally enjoyed our rambling chats at times, but I think it's been good quality. So thanks for that. And thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to everybody who's got in touch and expressed, just given us encouragement for doing it. I don't think it's going to be the last stuff that Conrad and I do together. I see him as my guy in Lorient, in the center of the French ocean racing world. So I'm sure we'll see some stories on the website and probably some podcasts, because I think there's going to be plenty going on in the professional offshore racing world. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, very definitely. And I like a good collaboration, and this has been good fun. But certainly for those of you listening at home, please reach out either to myself or to Justin and send us questions. I know from experience, as somebody who has been totally invested in this world, that it can be pretty impenetrable to sort of know what's going on. It is sometimes poorly covered. So I am your guy in France. And so if you've got questions, then send them your way, our way, and we'll do our very best to get them answered and give you a good scoop as to what's going on.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, for now, Conrad, I'll just say thanks, and I'll speak to you very soon.
Very good. Thank you.